It is a pleasure for me to introduce Ewan, because Ewan and I were exact contemporaries at Cambridge. And we were in the same college, both studying natural sciences and both members of the Christian community there. And we've kept in touch ever since. Ewan is got a very prestigious CV, really. But he's a man of many parts, and we had a long conversation. He was actually brought up in Rhodesia for a lot of his time. He's got many stories about Rhodesia and South Africa. And he maintains very close contacts. In fact, he was telling me, my visitor, you called it a shack, didn't you? But it sounds, looks quite like a nice house in South Africa that they still keep up. Ewan is actually an earth scientist, or a sort of geologist, geophysicist, or whatever you want to call him. And he spent several years in the far north of Canada, in Saskatoon, which I thought was very brave. But for many years now, he's been based in Royal Holloway College in London, where his wife was also a professor, then became Dean of Science, and is now Master of Darwin College, Cambridge. So it's a very academic family indeed. And in fact, you travel around as her consort, don't you, sometimes, to the around the world. Ewan's early research involved many years of work on the geology of Precambrian rocks, but his current work is on atmospheric chemistry, focusing on the major greenhouse gas methane. He leads the UK's Moya Consortium of 14 UK universities and institutes, studying the global methane budget. And tonight, we are delighted to have him with us to present the second lecture in our series on the fragile planet, Our Fragile Planet, A Christian Perspective. And he has the title, Caring for the Atmosphere, Are We Breaking the Rainbow? Ewan.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. And I must apologize. I'm not going to have too much about cows. And it comes out the front end of the cow. It's called bovine eructation. Not as the Daily Express assures you, it's the back end of the cow. It's a little out of the back end. There's, you know, humans do that too. But it's the front end, bovine eructation. That's the one thing you need to take home from this. But no cows will be harmed in this lecture. Mostly I'm going to talk about, as a scientist, trying to be an earth scientist, trying to understand the planet. I will indulge in a few slides about what we're doing about methane and a bit about what we did about Precambrian geology. But I'm trying to focus this on how Christians should approach this wonderful planet that we have, and what are we actually doing? And we work all over the place. Saskatoon was in the far north. It's not as far north, as far as I know, as Nottingham, I can't remember. But Saskatoon, on the other hand, at this time of year, is frequently minus 40, where it doesn't matter whether it's C or F. And I remember standing at the bus stop at minus 40 and thinking, you know, if that bus doesn't arrive at 7 in the morning, it's 5 minutes and I'm dead, I'm frozen. Buses in Saskatoon come, because otherwise they have no customers. I want to talk about the rainbow first, which is a very, very strange thing. There's some odd things about this planet, and one is the rainbow. And are we doing strange things to it? Are we breaking the rainbow? I'll talk about the greenhouse gases. Methane is greenhouse gas, that's what I work on. We're breaking it in a different way. We're polluting the place, which isn't strictly the greenhouse. It's what we breathe. And if you go to the center of any city, I'm sure Bristol is pure as the driven snow. It's there. And then I'll try to put this in the context of old man Noah, and then go back a bit to how did we get here? What's the back history of the atmosphere? And a lot of the research I've been doing for 30, 40 years has actually been about atmospheric history. I've got a spelling mistake there, but never mind. Talk about pessimism and optimism. Where are we going? So I'll start off with my house. I had a lovely thing as I was coming here on the train. The train came out of Bath, and you know it goes past that lovely wiggly river. And there was a rainbow that looked just like that. Perfect rainbow. Absolutely marvelous. And I thought, oh, yes. Okay. The rainbow is very important in the Bible. It was. I'm African. I grew up in my mom's hometown, a little place called Alice, which has managed to produce Mr. Mandela and Mr. Mugabe. And the Tutus are closely connected with Alice as well. Tutu's family used to stay in our shack sometimes. Alice knows a lot about rainbows. It gets rainbows. It's a very small little place in the back end of the Eastern Cape. And we have a lot of rainbows there because we've got some hills. The rainbow is odd. It's very odd. To get a rainbow, you've got to have water in the sky. That means you've got to have water in different phases in the atmosphere. It's got to be liquid and it's got to be vapor. You've got to have an atmosphere that allows water and yet lets sun shine through. If it's a really cloudy atmosphere like Venus, you wouldn't get that. And Venus doesn't have any water. It's lost its water. Venus used to have 5 kilometer deep oceans, probably, well, some kilometers. And they were lost to space. It got too hot. The water, the hydrogen got knocked out to space by radiation. And Mars, on the other way, is just frozen. But we've got this wonderful planet where the water gets up to about where you fly a jumbo jet, and that's called the cold trap, where the temperature is minus 60, and it falls down again. It doesn't partition into the stratosphere that way. Well, a little bit does, but not very much. And some goes through as methane and gets oxidized. But basically, water is trapped down here. And we've got this 3.5 kilometers of the stuff flopping around, and then a little bit in the air. That's very, very odd indeed. And so we have these beautiful, beautiful colors of the rainbow, different radiation frequencies. And of course, there's ultraviolet colors in there that we don't see. So it's red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. So infrared at the soft end, the heat radiation, ultraviolet going on towards X-rays on the hard end. DNA is not hurt by that radiation. It is hurt if you go harder into the hard ultraviolet. But we've got an atmosphere that stops the hard ultraviolet. It's called the ozone up there. We have, on the infrared side, we've got heat coming out that matches heat coming in. That gives you a stable temperature. If you block the heat going out, the infrared heat, then, of course, the heat's got nowhere to go, so it gets hotter. That's exactly what we're doing at the moment. We're blocking that outgoing heat. Okay. So the Earth lives... don't worry about this diagram, except to know that the Earth is in the bottom of this green triangle there. This is the water hole. On the Earth, we can see liquid water is all around us. Vapor water, which is in the air. And then icy water. I lived in Saskatoon long enough. Saskatoon goes minus 42 to plus 42 in about 8 weeks. Earth can do all three. That's very odd. Mars is over on the solid side. Equatorial Mars is just gets to the triple point. It just gets to zero. You can just get a bit of water there because it's full of brine salt. Venus has lost its water. Venus is way over on the far side in that brown area. And there's a little bit of hydrogen left at sulfuric acid in the clouds. Earth has just sat there. Okay, but it's worse than that because the young sun had a lot more hydrogen and it's converted that helium and started burning the helium. So the sun has been getting brighter over time. So it's not a stable point. You've got to keep turning down the greenhouse over the history of the Earth to stay in that point. You've got to run to stay still. And somebody's done that for us. The Bible's pretty strange. It's got an awful lot of stuff about the environment in it. And I may be wrong, but I've read bits, quite a lot of some of the great texts of the other religions. They're far less interested in the environment. It's all over the Old Testament, and it's all over the New Testament. And again in the Old Testament, you see these questions. Who's measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? Who stretched the line over the earth? Can you do this? Can you do that? There are two ways of looking at that. One is basically an insult, you know, a little man. Don't pretend. Great God's up there. Well, that's true. But the other way is a challenge. And the challenge side is, get on and do it. I want you to do that. If you're going to grow to the stature of the Son of God, then you've got to be able to do that. That's what scientists should be doing. Every comment like this, you can read as a challenge, particularly in Job. But it's all over the Old Testament, and quite a lot of it in the New Testament too. Do you know where the wind comes from? These are challenges. If I said that to one of my students, he'll take it as a challenge. That's what they do. When I was a student, I had a wonderful supervisor, Alan Smith, who fitted the continents, who died very recently, actually. And he used to just make these elliptical remarks. And you go away from the supervision and think, my goodness, I ought to be able to do that. It was a request, you know, do it. Measure the water. Now, in Saskatoon, we get rainbows. I lived 11 years in Saskatoon. I loved the place. It's a wonderful place. And I did a lot of work up in the north. Now, this is taken actually south of Saskatoon in the States, Fargo. But I used to see this quite frequently. Rainbows happen in different ways. Saskatoon in summer gets traditional British rainbows. That sort of rainbow is more common here on the equator. Because you need a low sun, you only get that sort of rainbow early in the morning or late at night. But in 50 North, you get them pretty frequently because the sun is it's behind you and you get these beautiful bows. But what you also see in Saskatoon is sundogs. And you see this trinity, the sort of great sun in the middle, and then these two wonderful rainbows on both sides. And that's, of course, water vapor in the air making ice. It's stunningly beautiful. And, you know, as I said, this planet has vapor, liquid, and solid water all together. And they make this beautiful trinity. Some of you might have seen the Brocken Spectre, which you can see here in Britain. And I've once seen a marvel. I was going down a hill in South Africa near my family cottage, and the sun was right behind us, shining down the hill. And what we got was an almost perfect circle because of the topography of the hill, with ourselves in the middle. You may have once or twice looked out of an aeroplane, and you can see the aeroplane in the middle of a round rainbow. That's a Brocken Spectre. Human beings sort of stand in the middle of the rainbow. We can change the rainbow. If we heat up the planet, we're going to change the amount of water vapor. We're not going to destroy rainbows, but we'll make them either more or less common, depending on how cloudy it is and things like that. We can abolish them completely by covering the place with pollution. Then you don't get a clear sun. And in some parts of the world, we've done that. So human beings can change the rainbow pretty easily. Are changing the rainbow. Now, Genesis says, have dominion, replenish the earth. What do you mean by replenish? Interesting question. Now, in Saskatoon, if you turn away from these, if you look at the sundogs there, just occasionally you see the anti-helical spire, which is at the opposite point. And this is a scary one. It just sticks up like that. And you think, my goodness, there's something bad out there. Yeah, it's your little picture of Satan there, with horns. I'm a geologist. I worked for my PhD in Greece. I spent 8 years mapping in Greece up in the mountains and used to go down to Athens. And one of the places I loved about Athens was the Hill of the Areopagus, Mars Hill, which is where the court of Athens was. and the Council of Athens met below it, the diplomatic, sorry, the Democratic Council of Athens. And this was really the sort of, I know the Parthenon is the great temple and so on, but the Areopagus was in some ways the core of the Greek spirit. And a lot of things happened there. And the guy who made the speech to the council of the Areopagus was St. Paul. He turns up there, and this is the moment of fusion between Hebrew culture and Greek culture. This great speech. What does he do? Well, he comes up with a couple of quotations, and he quotes a book by Aratus. It's a poem, but it's basically a scientific textbook. It's the great scientific textbook of the time. It talks about the stars, about weather. It's a wonderful book. Phenomena. That's where we get our name, our word phenomenon from. Aratus had written this a couple of hundred BC. Another chap who came from Tarsus had also written stuff on this. And this marvelous statue is huge. And if anyone's been to Naples, you've probably seen it. To me, it's one of the great statues of the classical period. Is holding up the world, or holding up the universe. It's based on Aratus. That's a star map, if you look at it. That's the outside of the universe. That's in the middle there somewhere. And can you see the star map with the constellations? Those are, even nowadays, we still, if you pick up the trash newspaper, you can see your fate in the stars. Those constellations. My son-in-law is a consultant orthopedic surgeon, and he took one look at this and said, wow, that's just right. I think it's called kyphosis. There must be an orthopod here somewhere. He's carrying this huge weight. You see what's done to his shoulder. And this marvelous expression on the god, this sort of, I'm holding it up. It's a beautiful, beautiful statue. It's Atlas holding up the universe. Well, it might be Hercules when he tricked Atlas, but I think it's Atlas. And the universe is a star map. It's a scientific map. It's a bit different from the stars nowadays because it has Arctos, the great bear, instead of the pole star, because, of course, the Earth's precessed since then. But it's a clear star map. And this is quoted directly by St. Paul. He's taking science as his starter. Phenomena is based on meticulous observation. Again and again he says, if you don't believe me, you can go out and look, test it. That's science. There's a lot in this speech, and I'm going to spend a little bit on this and then go and talk about what we actually discover. He quotes from the beginning of phenomena, we are also his offspring. He's talking to the court of the Areopagus. There's back history there, because Aeschylus, this is where in Eumenides, Apollo denied the resurrection. You know, human beings cannot live again. And was overruled in his judgment by Athena, the goddess of wisdom. And then Sophocles, in the same place, has Oedipus going into the mystery of the afterlife. He doesn't deny the resurrection, but says it's a mystery. And this mystery is a holy mystery that you cannot, only the king of Athens knows the mystery. And of course, St. Paul comes along and says, okay, here's the answer to this mystery. It's also probably where Socrates was condemned. Socrates is the originator of the scientific method. My kids, when they were learning violin, were told how to eat a bicycle. When you want to eat a bicycle, you don't sort of take the saddle first because it's a bit more digestible. What you do is you grind it up into an extremely fine powder and you take one teaspoon a day and hope it doesn't kill you. That's what Socrates said. He said, take each little bit, the elench, and then study that little bit, understand that. It's reductionism. You take the bits, you understand the bits, and then you'll understand the whole. Paul actually goes into maths as well, and Twice, actually, because in Titus he quotes it again. The Epimenides, who'd set up the statue to the unknown god and helped write the constitution of Athens, the democratic constitution, Epimenides was a Cretan, and he said Cretans are always liars. Is that a true statement or is not a true statement? You can't answer that one. If a Cretan says Cretans are always liars, you're really stuck. And in modern maths, this is Gödel's incompleteness theorem, that there's certain propositions which are true, but by their very nature cannot be proven to be true. Paul actually, in Corinthians, directly quotes Socrates, necessity is laid upon me, the word of God. That's Socrates in his trial, which Paul turns it into necessity is laid upon me if I preach not the gospel. So Paul is here saying science is valuable by directly quoting it. Okay, science is valuable. So I make that point first. Okay, let's go and see what we can now discover from a bit of scientific work. Hadley, actually, was the guy who figured this out. But the first person, really, who recognized that the air has mass was Job in the Bible. And Empedocles, also the Greek, also realized the air has mass. And they try to figure out, you know, why the wind's blowing. Aratus spends a lot of his time in meteorology. And the Luke Howard, who's the founder of modern meteorology, he named the clouds Cirrus and Stratus and Nimbus and Cumulus. Those are Aratian names. They're from Aratus. So the study of the clouds comes directly from Aratus. And our understanding of the climate of the planet, right now we're very close to the equinox, so the planet looks a bit like that. It's rising up in the tropics, and that brings in wet air to rain like crazy. It comes down over the Sahara or the Australian desert, so you get big deserts, and then you get the cold air coming out of the poles, and you get more rain in Britain. And then, of course, the sun, the years go to and fro. Okay. But we're changing that. And as we change it, these climate patterns are shifting. And they're shifting quite dramatically at the moment. I've been doing a lot of field work in Finland looking at methane emissions, and we had this wonderful field assistant who came along and spent ages sort of helping us. He used to sort of creep around our cabins all the time. It was very beautiful. In the end, we decided he wasn't an albino. He was just a white reindeer, and Santa Claus had lost him or something. He does emit methane. But the world, the vegetation and the animals of the world are adapted to the climate of the past few centuries. And if we change them, we are going to get big, big consequences. If, for example, it stops raining in India for 2 years in a row, or in China for 2 years in a row, or at least in North China, and rains too hard in South China, then we're going to have problems feeding them. At the moment, countries like India and China very sensibly have a year's worth of food supply. You can feed a small country like Yemen, where there's a famine for political reasons, but you can't feed India or China. So it's that type of change that may happen, or is happening. Big, big changes. If you look at the trend in global temperature, there's a lot of upping and downing. The last 4 or 5 years has been an extreme up, but on the other hand, we had some downs before that. It looks as if there's a fairly linear change been going on since 1982 or so. Pretty steep upwards. And we've added about a degree since the 20th century average. That's big. We're beginning to get into the realm of the sort of change between a glaciation and an interglacial. You need a few more degrees, but we're heading in that direction. That scale of change. If you can imagine the difference between a glacial planet and an interglacial planet, the planet one generation further down will be as far from the mid-20th century as we are from an ice age, or as the mid-20th century was from an ice age. We're already quite a long way from the mid-20th century. So things are happening. Why is it happening? I'm afraid this is probably copyright. I've never figured out who actually owns this one. Once when I was mapping in Zimbabwe, I was a kid. I think I was at school then. It was before I was even mapping. I was on the Zambezi River, and we had this sort of labyrinth shower, well, basically a shower made of grass walls up to about so high, watering can, and you just pull on the string, and the watering can comes down and washes you. And then a sort of, a bit like the War of the Worlds, this funny thing comes in and sort of sniffs you up and down. And I thought, maybe that's not so good. I thought the best thing to do was just stand there, because I wasn't actually wearing anything either. I was in a shower. And it went away. This is a very, very polite elephant. He's lifted the seat. He's just having a drink. Are the humans the elephant in the room? And the answer is yes. And this very brave lady is taking a photo. This is Botswana, but it happens in Zim as well, or used to. What we've done is we're blocking the outgoing radiation. And you don't need to look at or read this diagram. This is from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. But the top bar is the impact of the carbon dioxide. The second bar is the impact of the methane plus the add-ons that affect the methane. But there are also cooling things down here. This blue bar near the bottom, going that away, that's from the aerosols. In other words, smog, things like that. And the sum total is that we've warmed up the planet quite substantially. This is in watts per square meter. The sun produces 340 watts per square meter. We're adding 2 or 3 watts per square meter. So it doesn't sound like very much, but it's very significant in terms of the planet. The natural, without any greenhouse impact, the natural temperature of the planet is about minus 18 degrees. Add the natural greenhouse, the natural carbon dioxide, and the natural methane, and the water that produces. The biggest greenhouse gas is water, but the water responds to the other two. Oh, and I should mention N2O. Then the temperature of the planet becomes plus 15. There's a 33 degree greenhouse impact. That's the natural greenhouse warming, from minus 18, which is called the effective temperature of the planet, to plus 15, which is the real temperature the planet used to be at. And we're now kicking that up by adding 2-3 degrees of extra warming, which is what we're doing with this. And it's having rapid impact. I'm at Royal Holloway, and we've got a great picture of Man Proposes, God Disposes, the Franklin Expedition. My grandfather's uncle, actually, was up there on Resolute in the 1850s trying to find Sir John Franklin, and nobody could get through from Britain across the top of Canada. Nobody could get across the Russian side either. Incredibly difficult. And Grandad's uncle went up there and tried his hardest. Actually, they lost their boat. He got court-martialed because he refused to abandon ship. Captain Belcher abandoned the HMS Resolute, and they came out and came back on supply ships, and they both got court-martialed. Grandad's uncle got promoted to admiral, and Captain Belcher retired for abandoning ship. And the ship sailed out all by itself, unmanned, a year later, and was picked up by some Americans. The American Congress, which was pretty much at war with Britain at the time, bought it and did a very honorable thing. They fixed it up and they brought it back and gave it to Queen Victoria. And that was the start of the American-British alliance. And when they finally scrapped it, Queen Victoria made two desks. She got a saw and a plane out and she made these beautiful desks. And one's in Buckingham Palace. The other one is, unfortunately, got a pair of feet on them, belonging to Mr. Trump. It's in Mr. Trump's office. The Resolute desk. It's the president's desk. The Arctic is important for human politics, but it's much more important for the planet. If you've got a nice white top, it reflects all sorts of stuff. It gives you a cold point at the top. What we're doing is we're losing that summer ice, and that affects the planetary circulation completely. I'm sure I'm going to lose all this pretty soon, and I know I will then get sunburnt on top. Exactly the same. And this was the, I think that's 2012, but many years like this. Our Christmas presents are going to come from China because they get delivered in September. This is September, when it's minimum. They're going to be coming over the top there. And nobody's going to be bothering with the Suez Canal. It's much shorter this way. Yeah, we're losing the top end. And I make marmalade. When you make marmalade, you cut up the oranges. Well, I keep the oranges in the freezer, and then every now and again, I pull up these cannonballs and melt them and then cut them up. And then you heat them up, and then you throw in the sugar. And basically, Father Christmas is doomed. And within the next 10, 20 years, it's going to be gone. That's interfering with the planet. We're shifting the rainbows. What we're trying to do, actually, and here's a little bit of science coming up, is measure the greenhouse gases. And we have an informal partnership with ourselves and the Norwegians and the British Antarctic Survey and various other people, the Finnish Met Institute. We collect air samples from the bigger dots there. And our American partners, of course, have a network that's global, and they're doing wonderful, wonderful work. And then there are other groups in Europe, our French partners, they collect around the world too. And so we get these flasks of air coming in, and we have continuous stations. And we're trying to measure the greenhouse gases around the planet. And then you run the weather forecast backwards, where the wind came from. So you can find out if you get a blast of methane coming in the wind, run the weather forecast backwards. That wind was in the Congo 5 days ago, or something like that. And you can track back there. And then you do something called a mathematical inversion. And if anyone knows about Bayesian maths here, that's what you do. And you can actually work out where the source areas are. So it's what we're trying to do. This very informal network is there's a Cambridge Arctic scientist who went up. He's one of the first scientists in the Arctic in the 1770s, called Equiano. He's a wonderful guy. Wrote a marvelous memoir. And so we've called it after him because we also work very strongly on Ascension Island, which is right in the middle of the Atlantic. And he was partly responsible for the military base on Ascension Island, which was there to stop the slave trade. About a quarter of the British Navy was there for a while, for a long time actually, stopping the slave trade. Okay, greenhouse gases going up. We measure them. This is our place, Zeppelin, which is run by the Norwegian Atmospheric Institute. You stand up there and you can almost feel you can touch the North Pole. It's 400 meters above Nyalesund in the west of Spitsbergen. That's Jungfrau Joch, which is another one. Marvelous place. You get up in the dome up there, and it's 10,000 foot in the middle of Switzerland. But the more important ones are actually the remote ones, like Ascension Island or Mauna Loa. What have we done? We've become so drunken with our economic success that we haven't thought what we're doing. I love the story of old Noah. He rescues everyone. His ark has succeeded. All is well. What's he do? Goes off and gets drunk. That's how human can you get? It's a dreadful thing to do. But that's exactly what we've done. We've been incredibly successful economically. And we've gone and messed up the place. We've misbehaved. This is a map. It's a very odd map made by a friend of mine, Ed Dugakinski. The vertical bar is the sign of the latitude. So not in degrees, but the sign of the latitude. And that's actually proportional to area. So you can see the Arctic is actually a very small part of the planetary area, whereas the tropics is a huge part of the planetary area. That's the vertical bar. The horizontal bar is the year, is the time. And then the color on it is the growth rate of the greenhouse gas that I work on, which is methane, the second greenhouse gas, which is about 55% of the power of carbon dioxide. Politicians just talk about carbon dioxide because they can only have one idea in their head. But methane's much more interesting. And compared to CO2, with CO2 as one, methane's about 0.55. CO2 is about half of the greenhouse warming. There are other gases as well. And methane is a bit over a quarter. And you'll see that 2002, it rises. That's 2003, the very hot year we had up here in Western Europe. And then it falls down again. But since 2007, methane has been rising steadily. There are no blue colors on there at all. Red colors mean rising fast. Blue colors mean declining. And there used to be rise, decline, rise, decline, rise, decline. And then since 2014, it's just gone completely crazy. And that's what we're trying to figure out, what's going on. Methane is rising very fast indeed. And more than that, the type of carbon in it is carbon-13 and carbon-12. Carbon-12 is characteristic of methane that comes from cows or wetlands, swamps, or landfills or something, biological sources. Carbon-13 comes from fires and gas leaks and coal mines and also biomass burning fires. So by looking at the carbon isotopes, the carbon-12, 13, you can see what's been making the methane. And up to 2007, each year it was getting richer in carbon-13. In other words, the methane was going up because of gas leaks or coal leaks or fires. But since 2007, it's becoming richer in carbon-12. In other words, biological sources, probably. Or else something very dramatic happening in the destruction of methane, which would really mean that the atmosphere was in trouble. So here's what we call the flying carpet. This is a different way of representing that. The South Pole is down at the low end. The North Pole is at the top end. The years are along there. And the colors are, as you go up, that's the amount of methane in the air. And you can see there's a wonderful seasonality. That's to do with the production of methane, which is made when it's hot and wet. But it's also around the equator to do with the destruction of methane, which is done by something called the policeman of the atmosphere, which is hydroxyl, OH. Imagine a water, HOH, knockoff an H. Then you've got these OH looking around, oh, I'm lonely, I want to grab a methane. Sorry, I want to grab another hydrogen and become water again. Well, you go and get hold of a methane by a lot of complicated reactions, strip a hydrogen off, and then you become water again. And essentially what you do is you oxidize the methane to carbon dioxide. And because methane is a much stronger greenhouse gas than CO2, weight for weight, that makes it, once you've oxidized it, it's far less important. It's just CO2. And so the seasonality, these very steep dips around the equator, which is the middle of that graph, are to do with the destruction of methane. And in the southern hemisphere, which has lots of ocean, there's not very much going on for methane in the ocean. There's a bit. That's the seasonality of what blows south and the hydroxyl. So one of the other reasons why methane may be rising is that this policeman of the atmosphere might be in trouble. There might be less policemen. It's called the oxidative capacity of the atmosphere. That might be declining. And so we're having this great battle. We think it's because more methane's been made, but the Harvard group think it's because the oxidative capacity, the cleaning power of the atmosphere, is dropping. Either way, it's really important. And that's actually what we're arguing about at the moment, and nobody actually knows the answer. Well, the Harvard people say they know, but we don't know. And these are our types of measurements. The top one is at ALERT in northern Canada, and the left-hand panel is the methane itself, and you see this wonderful seasonality, because when it's emitted, up in the far north, of course, gas leaks, but also wetlands in the late summer. And then this is the carbon-13-12 ratio, which is coming down. And you can see the sort of inflection point about halfway along the graph, which is about 2007. This bottom one is the South Pole, and the second from the bottom is Ascension near the equator. And it's a global pattern. The methane is going up, and the carbon-12-13, the isotopic ratio, is going more negative. We got a global problem. So, who's making it? Ah, here are the cows. The people who make methane, the energy industry makes about a fifth of it. biomass burning of various different sorts, fires, forest fires, but also particularly African and South American, but especially African fires of grass. They make it. Cows make it. Agriculture makes an awful lot, 30-40% of it. And then wetlands make an awful lot. That actually is the British Equatorial Wetland. Did you know that we have an equatorial wetland? It's planted by Charles Darwin. It's about that big. It's on the top of Ascension Island. It's the most beautiful spot. And it gets exactly the same emissions as the middle of Amazonia, or the Congo, as far as we can tell. Anyway. Right. So the point I'm trying to make is that we really are changing the planet. And we're changing the wetlands. These are indirect changes. We produce an awful lot of methane from our coal mining, our gas mining, and from our cows, and from our landfills. But there's a feedback coming in from the natural environment. The wetlands are probably producing more. They're hotter, and so they're making more methane. You've probably seen bubbles coming out of a swamp or a marsh. Same stuff. So it's positive feedback. But also, we're getting the feedback in the sink, which is what the Harvard people are saying, that the cleaning power of the atmosphere is declining. That's changing the rainbow. It's also made in rice fields. And these are Grace Mugabe's cows, who have been very cooperative, actually. She ran the dairy that was supposed to poison Mnangagwa, but might not have. But anyway, they're very helpful. Cows are wonderful. They come and investigate. Well, you just stick a fishing rod there, and you sniff into them. And the top corner there is papyrus, which has a pretty big role in the Bible, actually. Okay. We've been trying to investigate the fires. All these red bits of fires, the top one is in December to February, and the bottom one is June to August. And the Natural Environment Research Council has a wonderful four-engine jet. That's us, that's my the view from my seat, actually. Where we fly through these fires. This is actually in Senegal. You can see the fire and you can see the red patches there. My postdoc said a very serious mistake. She forgot that the pilots were ex-RAF. And we were flying through all this stuff, and 5,000 foot, you know, collecting air samples. And then she said, no, we need a background. And the sea was about 100 miles away. So we flew out to sea, and she said, low background. So I could see it on my screen. You know, it was going 5,000, 4,000, 3,000, 2,000, 1,000. I thought, okay, we'll take a sample now. Oh, no, 98765. 500 feet, take a sample. No, 4,321, take a sample. No. And the wretched pilot went down to 50 foot in a four-engine jet. And then I realized humpback whales jumped to 8 meters. We could be the first four-engine jet. We get a Darwin Award for being the first four-engine jet brought down by a humpback whale. Or a manta ray, they do the same. But more seriously, these are feedbacks. The Earth is talking back to us. As you warm the Earth, you then get the feedbacks. This is the most beautiful tropical wetland. I'm about to go there next week, actually. It's where we do quite a lot of work. You wouldn't believe it, but it's actually in Hong Kong. There's a human ant heap just south of there. Hong Kong is 20% ant heap. Wonderfully, wonderfully constructed ant heap. Very ordered and very safe. And then 80% this beautiful wildlife park. And these are very lovely places. Humans can coexist with nature, even in a place like Hong Kong, where you have 8 million people in a very small area. It's the same size as the M25 loop. So I'm going to go away from the science in a moment, but scientifically, the Queen's question to the economists is pretty good. Why did nobody notice it? We really haven't done enough science to understand why. We don't actually know why there's 21% oxygen in the air. There's sort of partial explanations, but not a full explanation. We have lots of very sophisticated models, but we don't actually have a proper understanding. We can actually fix methane quite easily by reducing emissions from gas systems and coal systems. I'm not blaming the frackers. They're becoming actually, my friends in the States have been measuring them. Frackers nowadays are very tight. They're probably tighter than the British gas industry because it's money. You don't want to lose money. So cutting methane is relatively easy. It's probably much easier than CO2. Nobody's doing much. Okay, so let's get back to the sort of ethical problems. The old rabbis, like Maimonides, used to think there are various laws. There's the law of Adam, love God. And Noah and Adam, the rainbow is not just for human beings. The rainbow is actually for every living thing. I think I'd include plants in there too. The rainbow is for all creation. The rainbow is basically love your neighbor. It's a command as well as a promise. And the old Jewish rabbis used to think that the seven great laws that came from Adam and Noah, you worship God, you don't worship idols. You establish courts of justice, Cain and Abel. You do not commit murder, various other things. And also, you respect the life in non-human things, which is repeated in Acts, the council that says to the Christians, don't take the blood. They're going back to Noah. And it's very, very strong in Jewish thinking. Don't take the life. You, yes, rise, Peter, kill and eat. You have dominion over the animals. But you don't, there's some quality in there that's the life of the animals and of the environment. If you take that, then you're committing a very, very grave sin. And it's sort of echoed in St. Paul talking about the whole creation groaning. The Swiss are actually one of the cleanest countries in the world. They're very rich, but they also try very hard. I spent a while at ETH in Zurich, and I love the Swiss 50 franc note. I'm not rich enough to afford one. About buys you a cup of coffee. I don't know. When I was there, it was 4 francs to the pound. It's now much closer to 1 franc to the pound. But you see the map of the world there and the circulation of the world. And he's blowing a dandelion. And there's a cross in the background as well. Don't let your greed for money overwhelm your home. But that's exactly what we're doing. This is another Swiss photo. If you walk up the Seignes Pass, as I did, you come over the top, and you see this. Well, I'm a Southern African, but I also have a wife who's mostly New Zealand. You spot that. It's a very odd structure, 2,800 meters up in the Alps. And then you're sitting there thinking about things. There's a very sharp edge, and you can see forever. And out comes a little gnome from a little door tunneled into the hill. It's a Swiss soldier. And he sits there and admires all creation. And then he suddenly realizes it's a dunny. That's his toilet. And, it falls down the cliff, which is great. And that's pretty much what we're doing to the world. It's okay up there. This was actually taken in 2003, where you could see this incredible air pollution event over Europe. You should be able to see far, far further. We're mucking the place up. And we have dominion over nature, but are we Solomon, a fair and just king, or are we Stalin? And I think we're a bit closer to Stalin at the moment. So, let's see if I can get this thing to work. It's not recognizing me. There we are. I actually do quite a lot of work in East Asia. This is Hong Kong, cleanest city in China. In the winter, it gets the air blown from China. And this is what it looks like. Actually, London is getting a bit like this nowadays too, with the diesel pollution. And you see people walking around with face masks, many of them, partly because they don't want to get a virus, but a lot of it's air pollution. Do we actually need to wear a face mask in our own planet? We're not visiting Mars. The answer is yes. In the summer, Hong Kong is hot, but the wind's from the Pacific. It's very clean. But in the winter, it's like this. Now, I was in Beijing on November the 26th in 2010, and this was the day that the American embassy tweeted air quality was crazy bad. The reason was that when somebody programmed it, there was no... He'd put in the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency's descriptors, you know, bad, sorry, poor, bad, hazardous, don't go out. But the, once you got above 500 in their point system, there wasn't any number. So he just put crazy bad just to make the thing, the computer program work, I think. Who knows? And suddenly the American embassy, which is the only honest measure in Beijing, was tweeting crazy bad. I looked out of my window, and that's what I saw.
Awful.
And if you look at the satellite pics, the whole of China covered. And nowadays they've improved a little bit around Beijing, but at the costs of further out. That's true in India too. You fly over India, you just can't see a thing. It's quite likely that both in the industrial areas of India and China, people have sacrificed 5 years of their life for their wealth. Now, that's a trade-off that you can make, a government can make. The smoke of a furnace, which is what Genesis talks about. If you're so desperate for wealth, but there are other ways of getting to wealth, as the Swiss have shown. You just have to think. Well, it helps to be wealthy so that you can be clean. But you can also be clean and not wealthy. It's quite doable. I'm really having trouble getting these things to switch. Okay. Well, I mentioned the cleaning power of the atmosphere is maybe failing if the Harvard group's right. I don't think it is, but the Harvard people think. There's this reaction with OH. And this happens particularly in the middle tropical troposphere, just below where we're flying. That is what washes out all the dirties. It oxidizes all the dirties, then they become soluble, and they wash out. If we change that, we're really in trouble. And that is linked to ozone, which I'll get to in a moment. So how did we get there? The other great question is, where were you when it all started? This is a scientific question, and this is Job's wonderful chapter 38, which is, all the scientific questions are out there. Everything there is, that's what I've been working on. I want to be cautious here. St. Augustine, in his commentary on Genesis, talks about time as a dimension. Time is not a planet rotating or the movement of a body. This is Edward Deer pictures. This guy actually can't see, if you think in two dimensions. He can't see anything past his eye because his nose is there. It's going to block it. We see him. Mickey Mouse, talking to Minnie Mouse, or Minnie Mouse, can't see the buttons on Mickey Mouse's coat. All she sees is the side of Mickey Mouse. Two-dimensional thinking. We're three-dimensional, so we look down on Edward Lear's men, and we can see all those birds in his beard. But he can't see the birds in the beard because he lives in two dimensions. Don't know if Edward Lear thought about that, but okay. If you live in four dimensions, where the fourth dimension is time, then you can see our whole time history from when we're born to when we die. And that's pretty much what Augustine says. Don't bring God into time. God made time. Time's a created dimension. It's not just the movement of a body. And there's also that wonderful passage in Hebrews about the day that's called today. So I get a bit ratty when people say that the accretion of the earth took 6 days, because actually the earth was probably spinning every 4 hours then. So it would have been quite quick. What is a day? Which is exactly what Augustine says, how fast is the earth spinning? Well, he doesn't say it. How fast is the sun going? Right, one thing we can do is look at very old rocks, and these are rocks, these are zircons 4.4 billion years ago. One of my friends, Bill Compson, measured this one. And they actually have some evidence for the existence of liquid water oceans. way back 4 billion years ago. Go through time history. Sorry about this. You can see old rocks. These are rocks we work on called Kamatiats. And they were the ones that degas. They erupt and they give off a lot of water. And we've got about 3.5 kilometers of wet stuff on top of us. And although it's had periods of snowballs where a lot of it froze, there's always been a bit of wet stuff there ever since life began. Otherwise, life would become extinct. We were wandering through rocks in Zimbabwe a long time ago. I didn't find these. My friend Tony, who's in the photo, he found them. And you find these wonderful odd structures. We found some other ones as well. They're called stromatolites. And when you actually take them apart and look at them, there's more of them there. They're absolutely beautiful to see. And they're associated with very shallow water silts. These have actually got mud cracks in them. It's the sort of thing you see on a beach. My finger doesn't do this. And then take it apart and actually look at the carbon isotopes and so on. You can find all sorts of biological stuff in there. And you can actually work out the biological communities. There's cyanobacteria making the big structures, but then there are also sulfate-reducing bacteria, there are methanogenic archaea in there, and there's a huge amount of carbon. Some of these things are pretty close to coal, and there actually was some oil in them. They're very, very well preserved. And you can work out the biological communities of all these many, many years ago. Maybe I need another thumb here. Okay. And what's happening? This is a very complicated scientific diagram. Don't worry. If you look at the dotted line there, Jim Lovelock made this point ages ago. The sun has been getting warmer steadily over time. And what we've been doing is actually changing the color of the planet and changing the management of heat so that we've had a fairly steady temperature throughout. And initially, we probably had methane very strongly in the atmosphere with the reducing atmosphere, give you a very strong greenhouse effect because of a much weaker sun. And then when the oxygen, there was a great threat, it's called the great oxidation event, when the atmosphere becomes oxidizing and the methane goes. You'd get a cooling event and probably a big glaciation. And there have been big shifts. But broadly, over the whole history of the planet, we've kept liquid oceans with one or two big problems. And we've switched from a methane-rich atmosphere to an atmosphere that's oxygen-rich, methane and CO2-rich initially. Now it's oxygen with a little bit of CO2, just enough CO2 to keep the planet right at 15 degrees. And these are the guys who've done it. If you go to the Ontario Science Centre, you don't get stuffed koalas and things. You get stuffed cyanobacteria. These are the cyanobacteria. And the little yellow thing in the middle is the heterocyst that actually manages the nitrogen budget as well. Wonderful things. And they date from the late Archean. They've managed the planet. And there's a very, very complicated management system going on between the biology and the greenhouse that's, with some ups and downs, kept the system in a remarkable stability, just dropping down the greenhouse as the sun has got brighter. Now, so, summarizing so far, with the greenhouse, we're really messing up the rainbow. With the air pollution, you can't even see a rainbow. The command to Adam was dominion over the planet, replenish the planet, don't destroy it. The command in Noah was protect the lifeblood in the living things. Don't destroy that. You're a monarch of the planet. You're not a dictator. Well, we do have some good points. In the 1980s, the ozone hole was predicted and then discovered by Joe Farman in Cambridge. And Margaret Thatcher, now I'm not a natural supporter of Margaret Thatcher, but she had a very good chemistry master's degree. Her supervisor got a Nobel Prize. She was an excellent chemist. She read the papers. She took the scientific papers. One of my friends told me, he was there, took the scientific papers and read them and realized that if we don't do something about the lack of ozone over the Antarctica, it's going to get really bad. She was absolutely right. If we had done nothing, by now, we'd have an ozone hole over the planet part of the year, and our spring greens out there would be getting frizzled by ultraviolet. Never mind us getting skin cancer, you'd be destroying the crops. It would have been very, very serious by 2020. We stopped it just in time. It's healing now. It's going to take another 30, 40 years to heal. And this was the ozone treaty that actually came into force at the beginning of 1989. And it's made an enormous difference. It also happens to be the best single action we've taken on the greenhouse because the chlorofluorocarbons, which the treaty was stopping, also happen to be very, very powerful greenhouse gases. So the Montreal Protocol really made a difference. It's the best single thing we've done altruistically for the whole planet. Kyoto did nothing, but the Paris Agreement at the moment is beginning to work. That zero is what the Paris Agreement planned, and the red dots are where CO2 is going, and it's sort of on track. They expected CO2 to go up and then come down. The one that's not on track is methane, which is the green one, which we really need to do a lot about. The Paris Agreement might work. The US has not yet withdrawn. They can only withdraw one day after the next presidential election, which is a brilliant move by Barack Obama, I think. They've just given notice of withdrawal. Oh, dear. Come on. Next slide. Okay. My wife's office has a vine and a fig tree beneath it. It's most beautiful. This is just below my wife's office, actually. And I think Sir George Darwin or somebody planted this long ago. In the Bible, the vine and the fig tree, they're the symbol of peace, where you can sit under your vine and your fig tree. It's in Micah. It's three times Micah, Kings, and Zechariah. There's deep, deep pessimism. CO2 is going up. Methane's going up. Pollution is in terrible. It's absolutely terrible in China and India and many third world cities, big cities in the third world. And London's nothing. You know, even a city like Cape Town or Johannesburg's far, far worse. But there's also optimism that we do have the technical skills. Even guys like Elon Musk, who's South African Saskatchewan, interesting guy. Solar power, all sorts of things. I'm actually in favor of nuclear power. David Mackay, who was one of Mary's fellows, wrote a wonderful book called Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air, and it's well worth reading. His father, actually, Donald Mackay, was a wonderful Christian thinker. David was not, but he was a very ethical person, nevertheless. And there is optimism in East Asia and even in India. There are really deep signs of concern. There is hope. And I think with a bit of prayer and a bit of hope, there are a lot of people trying to do a lot of good. And Obama, I think, was actually pretty high on that list. So I'm going to end with Constable. Constable drew an impossible rainbow. That rainbow can't exist. And he knew it. Constable knew all about rainbows. He was in touch with Luke Howard, who was who took Aratus's names into the clouds. The Dean of Salisbury actually lived just up the road from Jane Austen's brother. This little group, they knew a lot about weather. Jane Austen actually was the first person to describe properly the passage of fronts. It's in Emma. Job said, speak to the earth and it'll teach you. What Constable is doing here is saying that what's not possible with us is possible with the creator of the earth. You can do things. Salisbury Cathedral's in serious trouble. If you look at that cloud, it's not a good cloud. It's a very bad cloud. But, you know, there's the rainbow. it's okay. Somebody's looking after you. So I'm hopeful, but I think this problem is very, very serious indeed.
Tina will go around with a mic. If anyone has a question, just raise your hand.
How does it work? You just hold it. Okay. If anyone here is aware about something a few years ago that occurred called ClimateGate, which was revelations from the University of East Anglia revealing enormous evidence of deliberate manipulation and corruption of climate data, of which the University of East Anglia was just one of the parties in, there is a completely alternative view to the things you've been talking about, which is that the idea of anthropogenic climate change or global cooling, as we used to be threatened before that became inconvenient, is fraudulent entirely and is in fact part of a way of exercising as much control as possible over all processes on the planet by ultimately equating energy with money or carbon with money. And that I believe that that is so, and I say that as an ex-Green Party member and ex-environmental activist.
Well, a couple of answers to that. First of all, the warming that I've seen, this is in my own experience. I've spent, the first time I traveled between Europe and Africa must have been, in my memory, I did it before that actually, about 1953 or 1954. So I've got 60 plus years of looking at Africa. I've been flying up and down Africa since the late 1960s. I've worked a lot in the Arctic, and I've seen the changes there. These are very big changes. They're visible. The Arctic, you can actually see the changes. And in my lifetime, in my experience, so that's my personal answer to this. The wider answer, if you look at the records, there are a lot. All the individual temperature points and the temperature records from the remote stations are collated totally independently. These are very, very long-standing records. They're what drive the weather forecast. You know, we're now getting to the stage where we can reasonably accurately know the weather for 4 or 5 days onwards. That's based on those same numbers. And there are lots of independent groups. It's not just UEA. UEA were the first people who added it up. Well, they weren't the first. They weren't the only first, but they were one of the first groups. They're the ones who got all the publicity. Yeah. So my answer is no. Those numbers are very robust indeed. And the graph I showed you there comes from Stefan Rahmstorf. It's based on robust independent numbers. Nothing to do with UEA at all. Now, when you talk about UEA, I will actually defend them. I've actually sat in a panel opposite the guy who was involved, and yeah, I found him quite difficult to deal with, actually, but that's another story. One of my friends, Peter Liss, came in to investigate that, and he decided they'd been pretty stupid and they'd done some fairly borderline things, or more than borderline things, that they shouldn't have done. Who knows who hacked their emails? It's probably our friends, the Russians. But the point was that the basic numbers, they're right. Even with the UEA lot. So from my own experience, from all the other... the people measuring temperature in Ascension Island aren't part of some vast conspiracy. The people measuring temperature up in Spitsbergen, I've met them. Every day you go up to the top of the hills, 400 meters up, And there's a whole bunch of instruments there. You have to maintain them and keep them running. That's what I showed you, that photograph up there. It's totally independent of anything that some great conspirator in UEA does. The UEA guy was, you know, he was a bit... never mind. Well, do mind, because you shouldn't be doing that. But it was gross stupidity. It wasn't, I don't think, you know, I've met him. He's not a mad criminal. He's just a bit, too explicit in his email, shall I say. He was trying to make things fit in terms of deciding which data he thought were good and which weren't. And he probably, in his decisions, allowed his views to bias his observations. But that's not true of the vast majority of people. And when you find this in science, yeah, you're tough in it. We are tough in it. If I find anybody in my lab who's writing down the wrong number, I get really cross with them. Because science is about searching for truth. If you're not searching for truth, you're not a scientist.
Did I see on one of your slides something about long-term models are frowned upon or not encouraged?
No, long-term measurement. It wasn't models. Models are loved.
Sorry, long-term measurement.
No, one of our biggest problems is maintaining long-term greenhouse gas measurement.
Does that mean...
even the carbon dioxide measurement at Mauna Loa has got a gap in it because Dave Keeling ran out of funding.
When do these measurements start in terms of what you display?
The carbon dioxide measurements start around about 1960. That's from Mauna Loa. The main network of measurements starts in the early 1980s, particularly for methane. That's the NOAA network. And NOAA does have basic funding, though they're threatened with a 40% cut at the moment, which may be targeted on this. Our own measurements, for example, at Ascension Island, we have to maintain on three-year grants, on hypothesis testing, they're competitive grants. And if we don't get a grant, then the measurement stops. One of the key gaps in our knowledge, actually, is of the carbon isotopes of methane in the Arctic. The Arctic suddenly and dramatically changed in 2007. Our records stopped at the end of 2006 because the European Union cut our funding, said it wasn't worth measuring. And we only reinstated that about 4 or 5 years later. Ascension Island had an ozone, stratospheric ozone record run by the Americans from the 1950s up to about 8 or 9 years ago, and then they cut that just at the time when tropical ozone was becoming a really interesting problem. They've now reinstated it, but there's a gap of 4 or 5 years in the record. Maintaining long-term measurement, governments hate it. It's a long-term commitment.
Just a funding.
Yeah, it's a funding problem. Well, it's because science is funded on hypothesis testing. Mr. Darwin, you want to sail around the world for 3 years. What hypothesis are you testing? I'm not going to fund you.
Hi. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about methane, the dangers that poses. We hear a lot about attempts to control CO2 emissions, but is there much being done on that, and where is it actually coming from?
We know. Well, methane, there are two questions. Where's it coming from and why is it rising? Where it's coming from, a lot of it is from swamps and wetland, a lot of it is from cows and agriculture, and from energy leaks, the gas industry and the coal industry. Gas industry loses a couple of percent of the gas just on the way. And then it's also, so that's agriculture, wetlands, and industry, and then it's also coming from biomass burning and so on. The rise in the methane, though, is what we're arguing about, and we think it's a lot of that's tropical wetlands. It may also be tropical cows. It seems to be rising mostly in the tropics. It's not actually the frackers. The frackers have put the coal industry out of business, which has actually probably dropped the methane emissions because the coal industry emissions have been stopped. And the frackers used to be, one of my friends measured them for NOAA. She found that they were losing 9% of their gas just to air, And I think they panicked and thought, oh, that's 9%. That's a huge amount of my profit, actually. It's probably 50% of my profit. And nowadays, the frackers, the more recent work on the frackers, in methane terms, they're actually very, very good. I'm not going to talk about their water, but their methane's good. So methane is rising, I think, because of climate feedbacks in the tropics.
Kind of follow-up from that. If global warming starts to melt the permafrost in the Russian steppes, has anyone modelled how much methane...
Yeah, I was actually the guy who started that little hare back in the 1980s. I pointed out that the amount of methane hydrate there is very large, and I wrote a couple of papers on that. We've done a lot of... That's one of the reasons we're doing lots of work in the Arctic. The conclusion at the moment is that the hydrate methane, the stuff that's offshore, goes through water and gets oxidised, and the stuff that's on land mostly goes through soil and gets oxidised by methanotrophic bacteria. Not much is hitting air. The Arctic methane is coming in the summer from wetlands. You can show that from the isotopes. And in the winter from gas fields. There could be big blowouts for big ruptured gas fields. There are one or two very large gas fields in the Arctic that could blow. At the moment, though, the hydrates look as if they're not our biggest worry. I think I'd better catch my train.
Yes. So just thank you again. There are several points for me personally. I've been to China, experienced some of that smog, minerals. I come from Salisbury. I was just going to ask one question. Vegetarian. Do you think we should all be vegetarians? Is that a good idea?
I'll just shut. Yeah. My mother was vegetarian, and I'm sort of semi towards that. But there has been a fairly detailed look at that, and the answer's not necessarily. If you sort of eliminate all the cows in the world and turn them into soybeans or something, you're not actually necessarily going to gain. It's quite a complex set of equations. Sorry, of variables.
Yes.
So, I think the answer is you might feel better. I stick to organic milk. If possible, cows that run around. We do a lot of work with cows, and I love cows.
Yeah.
And cows should be allowed to run around, not sit in a barn and jam all year round.